Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're doing a looser, more off-the-cuff episode about the early Tim Burton short Hansel and Gretel and the Henry Selick short Slow Bob in the Lower Dimensions. A full transcript of this episode will be available in the show notes. Enjoy!
Hoi, hoi, hoi. Hello.
Hello. We had a bit of a mix-up.
No, don't tell them.
we're completely prepared and know what we're doing.
Absolutely, as ever.
Yeah, and and what we're doing is talking about some short animations.
Yeah, some early Tim Burton and early Henry Selick. So we haven't talked about Burton since back in 2018, when we had a regular kind of recording schedule and before everything became things were already terrible, but you know, before things became kind of chaotically and overwhelmingly terrible all the time.
Yeah.
So back in the salad days, we already talked about Beetlejuice, which is 15 rated. I've forgotten that. I recently showed it to George and Matilda, and I don't know if that's, there are a few swears, and also I guess
it's a little bit scary. There's some scary puppets.
Yeah, Beetlejuice himself spends a lot of time harassing and generally behaving inappropriately, so that's probably good that it's 15 rated, really. And as you say, yeah, there are scary bits. There's a fair amount of kind of, not gore per se, just sort of mangliness. Bodies.
Yeah, it's a bit gnarly.
Yeah, I mean, George mostly found it funny though, so he seemed to cope all right with it. very amused by how the two, our two friendly protagonists who become the friendly ghosts get offed by a dog. if you remember, they are in their car, sort of balanced on the edge of a plank of wood, like a seesaw, and then yes. The dog kind of steps off the end and looks very pleased about it. And, yeah, George is very keen on that. I think he enjoyed the dog's moxie. I think.
Mm. And I think was it a different episode when we talked about a few of the shorts, the Burton shorts as well?
Yes, so that's partly why I mentioned it, is that we talked about Vincent and a bit about Frankenweenie as well.
Yes, because it had Shelley Duvall in it, didn't it?
Oh, that's why, because you love Shelley Duvall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So Vincent was sort of his first... I mean, obviously, he'd made some amateur stuff when he was a kid, just, you know, like your Peter Jacksons. but Vincent was his sort of first kind of standalone short film, which was made at Disney and sort of budgeted by Disney, and obviously Vincent Price narrating.
I watched a short, a little YouTube about early Burton stuff, and it was saying that he was hired to work on a Disney film, but he was too creepy for it or something.
Yeah, so he worked on Fox and the Hound, is my brother's favourite Disney film as a kid, actually, which is where he met Henry Selick, who was also animating on it, and they then I think also both worked on The Black Cauldron. I'm kind of surprised, yeah, I think we watched the same video, actually. And I was surprised that said that, you know, Burton did a lot of this sort of great, I guess, art design stuff, you know, character work for the Black Cauldron, and it wasn't used. I was quite surprised by that, because the Black Cauldron is notorious as one of the scariest Disney films.
Is it? I haven't even heard of it.
Oh, no, what? I think we must have just both been either too young by a couple of years or too scaredy to watch it as kids.
Possibly both, yeah.
Because I haven't seen it either. Definitely one we'll have to do a future episode on. Not least because it's also one of the first Sierra adventure game film-to-game adaptations. So circa King's Quest, Sierra also did a presumably hard-as-nails, you die at any given opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Adventure game of the Black Cauldron. so, God, maybe this is our chance to expand into Twitch streaming, because that's where it's at today, isn't it?
I do keep seeing the Goosebumps game on the Switch store and being like, maybe?
Is that like a completely new one, or is it like a remastered one of the old FMV game?
No, I think it's a new Goosebumps game.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we could do probably a whole, because there was a Goosebumps board game as well that at some point someone bought for me as an adult. And
well, we'd have to do that with Ava if we're doing a board game.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. For that perspective.
I'm sure Ava would. I think, you know, I'm always happy to have Ava back on. You know, if listeners, you haven't listened to the Deptford Mice episode where Ava joined us, they're well worth listening to.
Yeah. Well, she was on, joined us for our Deptford Mice epic and the witches, I think, and also what was that? What's that Halloween show? Halloween cartoon, Over the Garden Wall.
Oh yes, yeah.
Yeah. So we've had a batch of Ava, and since then she's been doing podcasts with Shut Up and Sit Down. So,
that's great.
Well into the podcast.
Oh, wow.
But we gave her a start, though, you see. anyway, what were we talking about?
Vincent, which we have already covered. So if you want to hear our thoughts on Vincent, if you go back to February 2018, when we talked about Beetlejuice, so it's one of our earliest episodes, actually, when we discuss Vincent and Frankenweenie. And these are a lot more seen than the kind of two animations we're going to talk about today, one of which was almost considered lost, which is Burton's adaptation of Hansel and Gretel. It's a 1983 TV special for the Disney Channel, only broadcast once. And I first saw this at a Tim Burton retrospective, like an exhibition in Prague.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was amazing. 5-6 years back. And I think it was the same exhibition that played at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, or it had a lot of the same kind of objects. So it had, you know, Oogie Boogie was there, like lots of the, yeah, loads of the models from Nightmare Before Christmas and Corpse Bride. Lots of his drawings. So that was all really exciting. But one of the things that really caught my attention was this, a screen playing this Hansel and Gretel on loop, which I'd never heard of before. And I sat and watched the whole thing, and I just found it, I was really captivated by it. You know, it was so strange and so obviously Burton in terms of like the art direction and the kind of objects and what the set looked like. But also quite different as well, like a lot more stagey, I suppose. Low budget. I'd never even heard of it. And I think since then, some enterprising soul has uploaded it to YouTube, and it's very much, which presumably the version you've watched.
Yeah. Then,
and very much ripped from video. So,
yes.
Someone, thankfully, you know, recorded it when it showed on television, on cable. Now it has.
So you're one of not many people who've seen a high definition version of this.
As you say, high definition. I mean, you know, it was made for TV, and it looks like a made for TV film. But yeah, I suppose I have seen this in slightly better quality. So yeah, it was introduced on this sort of Halloween special, Halloween 1983, by Vincent Price. So obviously Vincent Price also narrated Vincent, inspires obviously the main character in Vincent, and remained friends with Burton until his death. Obviously his last sort of big performance is in Edward Scissorhands as Edward's sort of father and inventor.
It's been a long time since I've seen Edward Scissorhands.
Well, definitely one we'll do at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It holds up well, actually. I think as early Burton goes, Edward Scissorhands possibly holds up the best. One I've rewatched quite a few times. So, yeah, this was filmed on just a budget of $116,000. Was filmed on 16mm rather than on video. And yeah, it's mostly live action, like a very small amount of stop motion, but more just puppetry than stop motion, to be honest. Like there's a great hand puppet sequence. And yeah, it's in some regards a pretty straightforward adaptation of Hansel and Gretel. I say that not in terms of how it looks, which is wild, but in terms of the story, you know, this is your brother and sister with a cruel stepmother who wants to get rid of them. They get lost in the woods, but are able to find their way back by leaving a trail of stones or breadcrumbs. But then they get lost in the woods again, and then in this version, the stepmother dispatches a kind of robotic duck to eat the stones. But I don't think the robotic duck is in the original fairy tale, but, you know. And so they get lost. They find their way to this gingerbread house. When I say gingerbread house.
Yes.
So what do you think the house is made of?
Like malwams? Stretchy sweetie, like maybe those horrible chewing gums you used to get in the 90s that had like a liquid center, because something gooey and tacky and on the outside and then gushing on the inside.
it's kind of like the awful equivalent for sweets.
Yes,
you know, like with meat you have like offal, like, you know, all the gristle and organ meats and bits and bobs. It's kind of like that, but for sweets.
Yeah, absolutely. Only a child would want to eat.
Like it looks absolutely abject and repellent. It's horrible. In fact, let's get in early with texture of the week.
Absolutely.
I've got Antonia's electric guitar here, which I'm sure is not tuned. But let's try an E minor here. Yeah.
Okay.
Texture of the week.
I haven't prepared anything because I haven't prepared anything. So I'm going to go with the gushing sweetie house where when Hansel and Gretel turn up and just stick their fingers into it and it starts leaking gunge.
You know, the perennial sort of 80s and 90s TV favourite, gunge.
Absolutely.
Chemical gloop used to punish parents and teachers alike. I have considered doing like a really pretentious academic article about this TV
about gunge.
Special. Mostly about gunge, yeah. doing a sort of, you know, Kleinian psychoanalytic reading about this being like the mother's body and fear of damaging the mother's body or something. But I don't know, like basically, it's just really wrong and it's hard to put your finger on quite why it's so wrong. But this sort of weird, semi-permeable membrane of a sweetie gingerbread house. It's not okay.
It's not okay. The colours are really lurid as well. The thing it closest reminds me of is when I was at university and studying Faust, and we watched this kind of horrible like filmed theatre adaptation of Faust, where it was a German one, and where everyone was sort of, it made quite an impression. Yeah, it's, everyone was wearing this sort of horrible, like, clashing clothes and like melted makeup, and just looked like absolutely demented, and it was a really uncomfortable experience. And that's what this reminded me of.
High recommendation indeed. Yeah, I think, and it's hard to know what leaks, if what leaks from the house is like paint or something. Like, a bit worried because the kids do seem to be actually putting things to their mouth and stuff. So I hope all of this was actually, you know, non-poisonous and non-toxic.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't look non-poisonous and non-toxic.
No.
It looks like if you had a cartoon and you had to have a river of chemical poisonous sludge, what it would look like, basically. Like, if this was an episode of Captain Planet, you know, this would be the stuff you really aren't meant to put near your mouth.
Yeah, and I don't know, I mean, I think becoming aware that child actors were not always treated with the utmost care in the 80s and 90s. I hope they weren't poisoned by this miscellaneous gunge.
So it's worth saying, so we've got a fairly small cast here. So you've got Andy Lee as Hansel and Alison Hong as Gretel. And then Jim Sheeda as the father and Michael Yama as the stepmother and Wicked Witch. So the stepmother and Wicked Witch is kind of a dual role here. So I guess these kind of characters often mirror each other in fairy tales and make sense of this, played by the same character, same guy here in drag. What do you think this was, to give it a kind of pantomime? I mean, I guess pantomime is more of a British phenomenon than an American one.
It is, yeah, but it does give a pantomime vibe.
You will not.
So, you take their side against mine. Am I their mother or aren't I? Who besides me will bother to teach them their table manners? Will you have animals for children?
I don't know if I don't know if it's but because he was obviously going through, Verton was inspired by Japanese culture at this point.
Yes, so it's a completely East Asian cast. East Asian American cast.
Yeah, so I don't know if he was inspired by Japanese forms of, like, kabuki or...
Yeah, kabuki theatre thing. I mean, the witch costume is quite kabuki-like.
Yeah.
Like, with the sort of white face makeup.
Mm.
That did occur to... so maybe this is just the kind of point where, like, kabuki and pantomime kind of aesthetically cross over.
Yeah. Because I believe that they also have men playing all the roles in traditional Japanese theatre.
That makes sense then. I think that's probably a good educated guess there.
Yeah, I hope that's right. But I think that could be what's going on. And the kind of, I don't know, what do you make of the sort of Japanese influence on this?
I mean, it feels very much, I mean, Burton's, you know, I guess he's one of the first kind of, you know, massively successful geek directors, right?
Yeah.
In the way that's also true, I guess, of Peter Jackson or Edgar Wright. Maybe you know, Zack Snyder as well, and that means that he's very, very willing to indulge his own idiosyncratic interests, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know if there's much more to it than Burton was really into Japanese culture and was like, hey, yeah, I can have kung fu in this, and like a robot, like mecha anime. And like, I don't think it, you know, I don't think it damages it, you know, apart from the fact that watching it, you notice it, obviously, and you're like, huh, there's a lot of references to Japanese culture going on here.
That's, okay, yeah, sure.
I mean, I quite like the fact, I guess, that it ends up with Hansel and Gretel having a kung fu fight with the witch, and that the witch is using cookie cutters as some kind of intimidating weapon, so it's like nunchucks or something.
Yeah, well, they're sort of throwing stars, aren't they? What are those actually called? Shuriken. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, yeah,
they're cookie shuriken. Yeah. Which is quite cool.
So there's some neat little ideas. I mean, mostly, to be honest, I mean, did you find it a little bit slow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely the first half is pretty slow to get going.
Yeah, like, it probably didn't need to be half an hour long, realistically, because I guess there's not really much of a plot, and the viewer is likely going to know the plot already. So really, what if you're going to watch this, what you're in it for is the set design.
Yes. Yeah.
So what did you make of the set design and just the general look of it?
I mean, I think it's kind of remarkably consistent, right? That this is like early Burton, and it's like, you look at it and you're like, Burton. It's just...
Yeah.
And that's carried on, like, for his whole career, you know, the same... Like, this is like, yeah, he had a strong aesthetic from the beginning, and it's really obvious, like, yeah.
Yeah, that it has those kind of, that combination of kind of staid camera angles and then really kind of crooked shapes, these sort of German expressionist angles, and kind of combination of blacks and pastel colours, I suppose.
Yeah, swirly spirals and jaggedy things and spirals.
yeah, jaggedy things and spirals. Yeah. Sort of candy cane motifs.
Yeah. Twisty trees. I mean, it must have been... I mean, you can't really look at it now and imagine how it looked in 1983, because it's so familiar with Burton's aesthetic, but I imagine it was pretty interesting back then. Like,
yeah, it must have been really, really striking. Because, yeah, if you'd not seen anything like this before, and it looks a little bit like film theatre. You know, we've got these sort of very emptied out. It looks very kind of theatrical and a bit flat, but in a deliberate way. Like, I don't think. You know, that's fine. We've got a fairy tale here, so, you know, it doesn't need to be like this wholly kind of lived-in world. And, you know, there are some of the kind of objects to art that you get here crop up again. So the one I noticed was that there's this beaky little duck, like a kind of robot duck, which is just sent out by the stepmother to eat up Hansel and Gretel's trail of stones or breadcrumbs. And that crops up again in Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
As one of the badly thought through presents that Jack Skellington delivers as Sandy Claus.
Yeah, so the father in this version is a toy maker, I think. It seems mostly so they can get the get these little creatures in. The film sort of starts with a kind of seeing all the little toys and
little
movie things and their little legs around and stuff. Yeah,
like a little showcase. Which is great, you know, they look wonderful. Mm. There's a really nice wall clock, which is kind of Burton's variant on those cat wall clocks with the moving eyes.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I think that the most memorable part of this short, for sure, is the clown puppet.
Yes, so probably the best object in the film. Yeah, this sort of clown-like puppet then that kind of gets reprised almost as this gingerbread man, right? So they are different, but they look kind of similar.
Yeah. But, yeah, when the witch gets a hold of Hansel and Gretel and kind of and separates them, and Hansel gets sort of sucked into the bed and down into a kind of cellar where... yeah, he's visited by a gingerbread clown who demands to be eaten.
Through the medium of Rod Stewart.
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yep.
So bizarre.
So instead of "do you think I'm sexy," we have "do you think I'm, if you think I'm tasty, come on, eat my body," or something like that.
"If you think I'm tasty and you want my body, come on, Hansel, take a bite."
"I'm not eating anymore. You're disgusting."
"I said take another bite."
We'll have to... I definitely took a few screenshots of this clown because it looks absolutely... it's a real spectacle to behold.
It's a horror. Like,
it's a real horror.
The clown's definitely the thing that was giving children who watched the Disney Channel nightmares back in 1993.
Absolutely, and then this film disappeared from existence. So they just thought that they dreamt it. Like, actually,
oh god, yeah, it's a bit like me watching This Morning with Richard Not Judy. Anyone who isn't British, and probably even if you are, won't have heard of, but ridiculous comedy programme that was broadcast at all times at 12 in the, like, noon, midday on Sundays when we were kids. With Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, and it's a like a weird spoof of a kind of morning chat show, I guess. But yeah, had this hellish character called the Curious Orange. So just a disembodied orange head that asks curious questions and gets progressively moldier and moldier over the course of the series until it starts kind of screaming. And yeah, I was convinced I had dreamt that for a good decade, like, until I met other people who'd seen it at uni, like... Throughout my teens, like, I was like, nah, that couldn't have existed, no way.
But yeah, I mean, it's pretty similar. Like, you imagine, like, rationalising to yourself, like, there couldn't really have been a gingerbread clown that sang Rod Stewart to a kid.
Yeah, and had, like, razor-sharp, crooked teeth. And...
Yeah, on the Disney Channel, that's impossible.
it was acceptable in the 80s.
Yeah, as that song was talking about.
Yeah, specifically about the Hansel and Gretel 83 TV show.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it all has a happy ending. Well, not a happy ending for the witch, who obviously ends up being cooked in her own oven. I did appreciate that her oven has a child, you know, roast child setting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's she's handy,
like,
isn't it?
She's like, I set it to a 5-story cake. I should have set it to roast child. Yeah, which I thought was quite a good gag. But yeah, so they're reunited with their father, and then this sort of toy swan, which becomes a boat, inexplicably spews out gold coins.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
I don't quite know. Is that just a metaphor for this being like the father's like most successful toy yet? Like it's a real moneymaker, or
yeah, because who knows?
Yeah, if the father had the power to make toys that generate money, he probably should have done that earlier.
Yeah, to be honest, would have saved a lot of bother. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a definite curio, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Like, if you enjoy early Burton, like if you're someone who, you know, grew up watching Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands or Pee Wee's Big Adventure, then I definitely think this is worth looking up on YouTube. Just as you said, because it kind of cements Burton's style so early.
Mm.
You know, like he's in his early 20s or something doing this, and like he's basically got the signature style that he's going to have for the rest of his career.
Yeah. yeah, definitely. Worth a look for Burton fans, absolutely, if you haven't seen it already.
So the other film I wanted to talk about, which I have to say I like rather more than, I mean, I think Hansel and Gretel is fascinating, but I really love this, is Slow Bob in the Lower Dimensions. Which is a Henry Selick short from back when he was making... So he made a bunch of kind of animated idents for MTV.
Idents? Is that like
a... Well, that's why, you know, like those little stabs, like where you see the MTV logo. So he made a bunch of these back in the 80s, and that's... You know, he wasn't the only animator to do this. So Jan Švankmajer, the Czech animator, who does the... creepy, yeah.
Really?
So Flora and Meat Love, which both two like little 30 second odd films he did, were commissioned by and made for MTV.
Oh, wow.
And would have been shown between music videos. So, you know, when MTV started, I guess they reached out to a whole bunch of different animators to do these sort of short little promo things, and Henry Selick did some, so, you know, some with just the MTV logo. But then there's one that features this kind of character of Slow Bob, and this character then gets sort of expanded into a kind of standalone pilot, basically. And this was a kind of pilot for a proposed series in which this character of Slow Bob, who's this sort of curious, looks a bit like Henry in a Razorhead or something. You know, he's got this wild shock of hair. He seems to live in this apartment building, like, alone, like, in this loft flat. And, yeah, I think the idea is he would go on journeys to different places, different dimensions, and in these other dimensions, he's kind of a hero, basically, and saves the day. So, you know, he spends his sort of everyday living life, like, I guess just sort of sleeping on the ceiling, like a big spider in his flat, and then occasionally he's summoned to go into another dimension and save the day. So I don't know if this was exactly for children. I mean, it's always easy to make that mistake of thinking, oh, it's animated, it's got to be for children. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case. You know, I mentioned Jan Švankmajer, the Czech animator, and he would have never really seen his films as being for children.
Yeah.
With Selick, obviously, because he's best known for Nightmare Before Christmas, and then James and the Giant Peach, and Coraline, of course. it's easy to think of him as a kid's animator. I guess MTV was more going for a kind of teenage audience.
Yeah.
So is this the first time you'd seen Slow Bob?
It is, yeah. Yeah, I am.
So what did you think of it?
I really enjoyed it.
Hey.
Yeah, it's absolutely bonkers. I loved it. sorry, I'm just like, I'm just sort of watching it with no sound now, just in the background. It's just, you see Slow, when you first see Slow Bob, yeah, he's hanging on the ceiling being fed cola through a straw by a lizard. I mean, yeah.
Wake up, Slow Bob! Wake
and then he kind of crawls into a pentangle of lizards.
Yeah, so I don't know if the lizards like his caretakers, maybe, because the lizards, as you say, like feeding him this cola and says, "Wake up, slow Bob." So the lizards seem to kind of summoners, maybe, because as you say, they seem to cast this spell or something to transport Slow Bob to the lower dimensions.
But yeah, it's fascinating. It's really delightful. I love the mixture of live action and stop motion and puppets and
and cut out animation.
When he goes to the lower dimensions, there's photographs that are being menaced by scissors. that are photographs of people that are being cut. and are sort of trying to run away. So Slow Bob tricks the scissors by putting a photograph of himself. The photographs are black and white, but the animation's colour, over a road sign, so the scissors all fly at him and then break their blades on
it's a bit like that Looney Tunes gag with the the hole in the mountainside. There's actually just a drawing over a bunch of bricks or whatever. It's like this ingenious deconstruction of animation. The way that you can see the photos is based on, and it's very kind of few frames for the photos, right? So the photos kind of have a very stop-start animation style. So the photos don't kind of move in a really smooth way. So like, for instance, there's a little baby with a teddy bear, and one of the scissors kind of cruelly snips off the bear, and then it kind of cuts to the baby, sitting down and crying. And I guess I love stuff where like the medium of animation is really to put in the foreground, or like the animation itself is really emphasized. So I really like the way that these kind of material, these objects of the scissors, are cutting up the photos, and that obviously affects how the photo people are and how they feel.
And then at the end he comes back to his sort of empty attic, and there's a sort of conjoined twin puppet who had been watching through the keyhole, and they come and paint him with a sort of yellow paint. And that's kind of the end.
So I guess that's like the frame narrative. So if we're trying to imagine that this was a full series, presumably there'd be this sort of framing narrative of Slow Bob living in his apartment block alongside, say, these conjoined twins. And I imagine other neighbours and other apartment dwellers would have been introduced. So there's a kind of dynamic there where the twins seem to kind of want to torment or bully Slow Bob. Or tease him. So it starts out really from their perspective. And we kind of follow, we get this point of view shot of them kind of creeping down the corridor and then going up to the loft where Slow Bob's sleeping. And as you say, it's got some lovely sort of puppet work and stop motion there. It weirdly reminds me of early CD-ROM and Mac games, actually. There's something about the visuals that really makes me think of like the kind of weird games you got on Macs. obviously most people know Myst, right, and those kind of old puzzle games, they can maybe picture that, but a bunch of whole more sort of experimental games, such as one that the band The Residents did called Bad Down the Midway. And I mentioned the Residents because they did the music for this.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So what happened? Why didn't we get the full series? Why are we not living in that timeline?
I don't know. The music does crop up again on the Residents album Demons Dance Alone, actually. So there's a clip near the end after Bob has been painted and is back in his attic room. He's been gifted this watch by, like the Queen of the Lower Dimensions, one of these sort of paper cutout people. And she says to him, you see her on the watch, and she says,
"Over here, Bob! Bob! Over here! Time's up for now, Bob. Watch out. Watch out. Watch out. Watch out. Watch out."
And that's... right near the start of the Demons Dance Alone album. And there's some other connections here, in as much as the Residents also, of course, did some of the music for Pee-wee's Playhouse, the Pee-wee Herman TV show, which then Devo ended up doing the music for, and Mark Mothersbaugh did, which has started him, I guess, on that career of doing the music for Rugrats and other kids' shows. And, yeah, I do wonder then if that's when the Residents would have met Paul Rubens, Pee-wee, because, of course, you have this sort of connection that then Tim Burton does, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I don't know. Maybe there's just the fanboy in me. Obviously, I'm imagining, you know, Pee-wee, Herman, the Residents, Tim Burton, Henry Circle hanging out. Obviously makes me quite happy.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just, I mean, Selleck does, he's clearly a perfectionist, which is why his films look so good. They do tend to take a long time in production. You know, it's not like this isn't the only Selleck production where, say, funding hasn't materialised or it's been shut down. You know, it's been a long time since Coraline, sadly, and there was quite a big gap between James and the Giant Peach and Coraline. Monkey Bone, which is a fascinating but very flawed film, is mostly very flawed, I think, because Selleck was taken off it. So it's got this amazing art direction, it looks fabulous, but it's got a really stupid, kind of asinine, like, I don't know, frat boy humour. But according to Rose McGowan, that was the guy who was brought in after Selleck, because he was taken off the project. Presumably, I think it was going over budget and just taking too long, because, you know, stop motion is a very, very labour-intensive medium.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I can imagine if you're a Disney executive or something, and you're not necessarily going to get the results in the time you might expect or want. So I might be wrong, and I'd be interested. Interestingly, the copy of Slow Bob in the Lower Dimensions on YouTube seems to have been uploaded by Heather Selleck, who I think might be Henry Selleck's wife.
Okay, yeah.
So was uploaded directly by her, and you know, I'd love to know more about the project, obviously. I'm really glad this exists, because it's a wonderful 5 minutes of animation. But I can't help but think I wish there was a lot more of it.
Yeah, we're still holding out for that Henry Selleck Grim Fandango film, right?
Oh God, that would be so good. He would be the perfect person to make a film with Grim Fandango. Yeah. I'm looking for, he's got this sort of project which seems to actually, you know, be fairly late stage production at this point, with Key and Peele.
Oh, okay.
The comedians. So I'm quite Wendell and Wilde. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that because, you know, Coraline was 2009. So I can't cope with the fact that it was over 10 years ago, to be honest. Like, that's ridiculous. But, you know, it remains, even after 10 years, one of my favourite films of all time.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I'm holding out for it to be our, like, you know, 100th episode special or something.
Yeah, we need to do something special for Coraline.
Yeah, because, yeah, I freaking love Coraline. I think it's a masterpiece. So yeah, you know, I will admit to wishing there was a bit more Henry Selick out there. And you know, I do feel for him as well, because, you know, obviously for ages, Nightmare Before Christmas has just been thought of as a Burton film. And, you know, fair enough, Burton did the character designs and worked on the screenplay. But I think it was mostly a marketing decision that he'd become a pretty hot property, you know, off the back of Beetlejuice and Batman. And clearly selling it as Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, was a good decision from a marketing point of view. But I think... rough for Selick, whose direction is extraordinary on it, and the thing, you know, I mean, I love Nightmare Before Christmas, but the thing that really makes it is the animation, which is astonishing. You know, like when I think of like Jack Skeleton's really kind of balletic spidery movements, and you know, that's all Selick. You get those kind of movements again in James and the Giant Peach and in Coraline. I don't know, he's never quite been given his due, maybe, and never quite had the backing that I think he deserves as such a remarkable animator. But yeah, you know, the stuff that's out there is wonderful, and you know, I imagine, again, like with Hansel and Gretel, you know, if you're a Selick fan, if you love Coraline and Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, as much as we do, like, you know, you're going to enjoy Slow Bob.
Yeah, absolutely. Take 5 minutes to watch Slow Bob, and you'll it's great.
Cool. Well, so that's probably it. You know, they're short films, so there's not like loads and loads to say about them. I'm glad you enjoy them, because I know you hadn't seen them beforehand, so
no, it's good.
Okay, so what book is it that we're going on to talk about? Not now, but hopefully in the new year.
Wilder Girls?
Yes, Wilder Girls.
Yes. There's some fairly serious epidemic, teen epidemic novel.
Yeah, well, yes.
Which I think is possibly why I struggled with it on a reread. The first time I read it was before pandemic.
Yeah, so probably felt a little less close to home.
Yeah, I think that'll be our next one.
Cool. And then sometime in January, we excitingly have a kind of interview with Catherine Lester, who I've been in email correspondence with, who just a couple of months ago this year... published Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema.
Woohoo! Yeah, so that's exciting.
Which is exciting. So look that up. I've started reading it, so I've read like the first chapter. It's a wonderful read. She's, you know, it is academic, but it's not like pretentious or off-putting. You know, she's written this to be read. She obviously loves children's horror. It really comes across, and the cover has Gizmo on the front, looking adorable.
Yeah. So we will. We do have more episodes in the pipeline.
Yeah. So Catherine's going to be on, and she's going to talk about her book, and also, hopefully.
Yeah, I don't know if we should keep it as a surprise. What we're going to talk about.
I might edit that bit. But, I'll put a sound distortion on it.
Yeah.
So, sorry it has been rather slow the last year in particular. But I'm sure you all understand.
Yeah, we've all been somewhat in the same giant arc of
I think but But yeah, you know, New Year, and yeah, there's quite a lot. I was saying to you, Ren, before we started recording this episode, it does seem like there's been this sort of real uptick of interest in children's horror in academia. In recent years. So I think it's mostly generational, that basically people who are now in their early 30s are getting books out, and, you know, they grew up with the same kind of stuff that we grew up with.
Yeah. But yeah, that's exciting. It's
yeah.
It's obviously, we think it's a really cool area to talk about. So
yeah, absolutely. So it's lovely to see it finally get some actual proper attention.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well,
cool.
That was fun.
Thanks.
So for our usual stuff, we'll our artwork is by Letty Wilson. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. You can find us on Twitter at Still Scared Pod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. And yeah, it's always lovely to hear from people who listen. You can rate and review us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever it's called these days. yeah.
And Mackie's got some new music out recently.
Our theme tune artist Maki has quite a few new things up on up on her Bandcamp, actually.
I get notifications.
So she's been putting up more electronic pieces, and they're very good. I'll put a link to her Bandcamp in the show notes, and I do recommend checking those out.
And Joe now has three albums out, so two over the last year or so, under the name Wendy Miasma.
I was having a look at that. It looks great. that's Maki Yamazaki and Wendy Miasma on Bandcamp for to support the very talented musicians who have provided music for our podcast.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you have a sign up for us?
Yes, I do. Time's up for now, creepy kids. Watch out. Watch out. Watch out.
See you next time, spooky kids.
Bye.
Bye.